This is Audible.
Caiaphas Cain, For the Emperor, by Sandy Mitchell. Read by Stephen Perrin, Penelope Rawlins, and Emma Gregory.
Editorial note. What, for want of a better phrase, I will henceforth be referring to as the Cain Archive is, in truth, barely deserving of so grandiloquent a title. It consists merely of a single data slate, stuffed full of files arranged with a cavalier disregard for chronology, and to no scheme of indexing that I've been able to determine, despite prolonged examination of the contents. What can be stated with absolute certainty, however, is that the author was none other than the celebrated Commissar Caiaphas Cain, and that the archive was written by him during his retirement while serving as a tutor at the Schola Progenium. This would pin the date of composition to some time after his appointment to the faculty in 993.M41. From occasional references to his published memoirs, To Serve the Emperor, A Commissar's Life, which first saw the light of day in 005.M42, we can safely conclude that he was inspired by the process of writing them to embark on a fuller account of his experiences, and that the bulk of the archive was composed no earlier than this. His motives for so doing we can only guess at, since publication would have been impossible. Indeed, I placed them under inquisitorial seal the moment they came to light, for reasons which should be immediately apparent to any attentive reader. Nevertheless, I believe they are worthy of further study. Some of my fellow inquisitors may be shocked to discover that one of the Imperium's most venerated heroes was, by his own admission, a scoundrel and self-seeking rogue, a fact which, due to our sporadic personal association, I have long been aware. Indeed, I would go so far as to contend that it was this very combination of character flaws which made him one of the most effective servants the Imperium has ever had, despite his strenuous efforts to the contrary. For, in his century or more of active service to the Commissariat, and occasional less visible activities at my behest, he faced and bested almost every enemy of humanity. Necrons, Tau, Tyranids, and Orcs, Eldar, both free of taint and corrupted by the ruinous powers, and the demonic agents of those powers themselves. Reluctantly, it must be admitted, but in many cases repeatedly, and always with success. A record few, if any, more noble men can equal. In fairness, it should also be pointed out here that Cain is his own harshest critic, often going out of his way to deny that the many instances in which he appears, despite his professed baser motives, to have acted primarily out of loyalty and altruism, were any such thing. It would be ironic, indeed, if his awareness of his shortcomings should have blinded him to his own, admittedly often well-hidden, virtues. It is also worth reflecting that if, as is often asserted, courage consists not of the absence of fear, but the overcoming of it, Cain does indeed richly deserve his heroic reputation, even if he always steadfastly denied the fact. However much we may deplore his professed moral shortcomings, his successes are undeniable, and we can be thankful that Cain's own account of his checkered career has at last been discovered. To say the least, these memoirs shed new light on many of the odder corners of recent imperial history, and his eyewitness accounts of our enemies contain many valuable, if idiosyncratic, insights into understanding and confounding their dark designs. It is for this reason that I preserved the archive and have spent a considerable amount of leisure time in the years since its discovery, editing and annotating it, in an attempt to make it more accessible to those of my fellow inquisitors who may wish to peruse it for themselves. Cain appears to have no overall structure in mind, simply recording incidents from his past as they occurred to him, and, as a result, many of the anecdotes are devoid of context. He has a disconcerting habit of beginning in media res, and many of the shorter fragments end abruptly, as his own part in the events he is describing comes to a conclusion. I have therefore chosen to begin the process of dissemination with his account of the Gravelax campaign, which is reasonably coherent, and with which the members of our Ordo will be at least passingly familiar as a result of my own involvement in the affair. Indeed, it contains an account of our first meeting from Cain's perspective, which I must admit I found rather amusing when I first stumbled across it. For the most part, the archive speaks for itself, although I have taken the liberty of breaking up the long and unstructured account into relatively self-contained chapters to facilitate reading. The quotations preceding them are something of an indulgence on my part, having been culled from a collection of such sayings compiled by Cain himself for the apparent amusement and edification of the cadets in his charge. But I justify this as perhaps providing an additional insight into the workings of his mind. Apart from this, I have confined myself to occasional editorial interpolations where I considered it necessary to place Cain's somewhat self-centered narrative into a wider context. Unless otherwise attributed, all such annotations are my own, and I have been otherwise content to let his own words do the work. Amberley Vale, Ordo Xenos.
Chapter 1. I don't know what effect they have on the enemy, but by the Emperor they frighten me. General Karras of the Valhallans, under his command. One of the first things you learn as a commissar is that people are never pleased to see you. Something that's no longer the case where I'm concerned, of course, now that my glorious and undeserved reputation precedes me wherever I go. A good rule of thumb in my younger days, but I'd never found myself staring down death in the eyes of the troopers I was supposed to be inspiring with loyalty to the Emperor before. In my early years, as an occasionally loyal minion of His Glorious Majesty, I'd faced, or to be more accurate, ran away screaming from orcs, necrons, tyranids, and a severely hacked-off demon host, just to pick out some of the highlights of my ignominious career. But standing in that mess room, a heartbeat away from being ripped apart by mutinous guardsmen, was a unique experience, and one that I have no wish to repeat. I should have realized how bad the situation was when the commanding officer of my new regiment actually smiled at me as I stepped off the shuttle. I already had every reason to fear the worst, of course, but by that time I was out of options. Paradoxical as it might seem, taking this miserable assignment had looked uncomfortably like the best chance I had of keeping my precious skin in one piece. The problem, of course, was my undeserved reputation for heroism, which by that time had grown to such ludicrous proportions that the commissariat had finally noticed me, and decided that my talents were being wasted in the artillery unit I'd picked as the safest place to sit out my lifetime of service to the Emperor, a long way away from the sharp end of combat. Accordingly, I'd found myself plucked from a position of relative obscurity and attached directly to brigade headquarters. That hadn't seemed too bad at first, as I'd had little to do except shuffle data files and organize the occasional firing squad, which had suited me fine. But the trouble with everybody thinking you're a hero is that they tend to assume you like being in mortal danger and go out of their way to provide some. In the half-dozen years since my arrival, I'd been temporarily seconded to units assigned, among other things, to assault fixed positions, clear out a space hulk, and run recon deep behind enemy lines. and every time I'd made it back alive, due in no small part to my natural talent for diving for cover and waiting for the noise to stop, the general staff had patted me on the head, given me another commendation, and tried to find an even more inventive way of getting me killed. Something obviously had to be done, and done fast, before my luck ran out altogether. So, as I often had before, I let my reputation do the work for me, and put in a request for a transfer back to a regiment. Any regiment. By that time I just didn't care. Long experience had taught me that the opportunities for taking care of my own neck were much higher when I could pull rank on every officer around me. "I just don't think I'm cut out for data shuffling," I said apologetically to the weasel-faced little runt from the Lord General's office. He nodded judiciously and made a show of paging through my file.
"I can't say I'm surprised," he said in a
slightly nasal whine. Although he tried to look cool and composed, his body language betrayed his excitement at being in the presence of a living legend. At least that's what some damn fool Pictcast commentator had called me after the Siege of Perlia, and the appellation stuck. The next thing I know, my own face is grinning at me from recruiting posters all over the sector, and I couldn't even grab a mug of recaf without having a piece of paper shoved under my nose with a request to autograph it.
"It doesn't suit everybody."
"It's a shame we can't all have your dedication to the smooth running of the Imperium," I said. He looked sharply at me for a moment, wondering if I was taking the frack, which of course I was, then decided I was simply being civil. I decided to ladle it on a bit. "But I'm afraid I've been a soldier too long to start changing my habits now." That was the sort of thing Kane the Hero was supposed to say, of course, and Weaselface lapped it up. He took my transfer request from me as though it was a relic from one of the blessed saints.
"I'll handle it personally," he said,
practically bowing as he showed me out.
And so it was, a month or so later, I found myself in a shuttle approaching the hangar bay of the Righteous Wrath, a battered old troop ship identical to thousands in Imperial service, almost all of which I sometimes think I've travelled on over the years. The familiar smell of shipboard air, stale, recycled, inextricably intertwined with rancid sweat, machine oil and boiled cabbage, hissed into the passenger compartment as the hatch seals opened. I inhaled it gratefully, as it displaced the no less familiar odour of Gunnar Jürgen, my aide, almost since the outset of my commissarial career, nearly 20 years before. Short for a Valhallan, Jürgen somehow managed to look awkward and out of place wherever he was, and in all our time together I couldn't recall a single occasion on which he'd ever worn anything that appeared to fit properly. Though amiable enough in temperament, he seemed ill at ease with people, and in turn most preferred to avoid his company, a tendency no doubt exacerbated by the perpetual psoriasis that affected him, as well as his body odour, which, in all honesty, took quite a bit of getting used to. Nevertheless, he'd proven an able and valued aide, due in no small part to his peculiar mentality. Not overly bright, but eager to please and doggedly literal in his approach to following orders, he'd become a useful buffer between me and some of the more onerous aspects of my job. He never questioned anything I said or did, apparently convinced that it must be for the good of the Imperium in some way, which, given the occasionally discreditable activities I'd been known to indulge in, was a great deal more than I could have hoped for from any other trooper. Even after all this time, I still find myself missing him on occasion. So he was right there at my side, half hidden by our combined luggage, which he'd somehow contrived to gather up and hold, despite the weight, as my boot heels first rang on the deck plating beneath the shuttle. I didn't object. Experience had taught me that it was a good idea for people meeting him for the first time to get the full picture in increments. I paused fractionally for dramatic effect before striding forward to meet the small knot of guard officers drawn up to greet me by the main cargo doors, the clang of my footsteps on the metal sounding as crisp and authoritative as I could contrive, an effect undercut slightly by the pops and clangs from the scorched area under the shuttle engine as it cooled,
and Jürgen's tottering gait behind me. "Welcome, Commissar. This is a great honour." A surprisingly young woman with red hair and blue eyes stepped forward and snapped a crisp salute with parade ground efficiency. I thought for a moment that I was being subtly snubbed with only the junior officers present before I reconciled her face with the file picture in the briefing slate. I returned the salute. "Colonel Castine," I nodded an acknowledgement. Despite having no objection to being fawned over by young women in the normal course of events, I found such a transparent attempt at ingratiation a little nauseating. Then I got a good look at her hopeful expression and felt as though I'd stepped on a non-existent final stair. She was absolutely sincere. "Emperor, help me, they really were pleased to see me." Things must be even worse here than I'd imagined. Just how bad they actually were I had yet to discover, but I already had some presentiment. For one thing, the palms of my hands were tingling, which always means there's trouble hanging in the air like the static before a storm. And for another, I'd broken with the habit of a lifetime and actually read the briefing slate carefully on the tedious voyage out here to meet the ship. To cut a long story short, morale in the Valhallan 296/301st was at rock bottom, and the root cause of it all was obvious from the regiment's title. Combining below-strength regiments was standard practice among the Imperial Guard, a sensible way of consolidating after combat losses to keep units up to strength and of further use in the field. What hadn't been sensible was combining what was left of the 301st, a crack planetary assault unit with 1,500 years of traditional belief in their innate superiority over every other unit in the Guard, particularly the other Valhallan ones, with the 296th, a rear echelon garrison command, which, just to throw promethium on the flames, was one of the few all-women regiments raised and maintained by that desolate iceball. And just to put the cherry on it, Castine had been given overall command by virtue of 3 days' seniority over her new immediate subordinate, a man with far more combat experience. Not that any of them truly lacked that now, after the battle for Corania. The Tyranids had attacked without warning, and every Guard regiment on the planet had been forced to resist ferociously for nearly a year before the Navy and a couple of Astartes chapters had arrived to turn the tide.
A common mistake. It is, of course, virtually unheard of for an entire Astartes chapter to take the field at once, let alone two. What Kane obviously means here is that elements from two different chapters were involved, a couple of companies apiece from the Reclaimers and the Swords of the Emperor.
By that time, every surviving unit had sustained at least 50% casualties, many of them a great deal more, and the bureaucrats of the Munitorium had begun the process of consolidating the battered survivors into useful units once again. On paper, at least. No one with any practical military experience would have been so half-witted as to ignore the morale effects of their decisions. But that's bureaucrats for you. Maybe if a few more administratum drones were given lasguns and told to soldier alongside the troopers for a month or two, it would shake their ideas up a bit, assuming by some miracle they weren't shot in the back on the first day, of course. But I'm digressing. I returned Castine's salute, noting as I did so the faint discoloration of the fabric beneath her rank insignia where her captain's studs had been before her recent unanticipated elevation to colonel. There had been few officers left in either regiment by the time the Nids had got through with them, and they'd been lucky at that. At least one of the newly consolidated units was being led by a former corporal, or so I'd heard.
He'd heard wrong, or is possibly exaggerating for effect. The newly appointed colonel of the 112th Rough Riders was a former sergeant, true, but had already received a battlefield promotion to lieutenant during the defence of Corania. None of the senior command staff in any of the recently consolidated units had made the promotional jump directly from non-commissioned officer.
Unfortunately, neither of their commissars had survived so. Thanks to my fortuitously timed transfer request, I'd been handed the job of sorting out the mess. Lucky me. Major Brooklaw, my second in command. Castine introduced the man next to her, his own insignia equally new. His face flushed almost imperceptibly, but he stepped forward to shake my hand with a firm grip. His eyes were flint grey beneath his dark fringe of hair, and he closed his hand a little too tightly, trying to gauge my strength. Two could play at that game, of course, and I had the advantage of a couple of augmetic fingers, so I returned the favour, smiling blandly as the colour drained from his face. Major! I let him go before anything was damaged except his pride, and turned to the next officer in line. Castine had rounded up pretty much her entire senior command staff, as protocol demanded, but it was clear most of them weren't too sure about having me around. Only a few met my eyes, but the legend of Kane the Hero had arrived here before me, and the ones that did were obviously hoping I'd be able to turn around a situation they all patently felt had gone way beyond their own ability to deal with. I don't know what the rest were thinking. They were probably just relieved I wasn't talking about shooting the lot of them and bringing in somebody competent. Of course, if that had been a realistic option, I might have considered it, but I had an unwanted reputation for honesty and fairness to live up to, so that was that. The introductions over, I turned back to Castine and indicated the tottering pile of kit bags behind me. Her eyes widened fractionally as she caught a glimpse of Jürgen's face behind the barricade, but I suppose anyone who'd gone hand to hand with Tyranids would have found the experience relatively unperturbing, and she masked it quickly. Most of the assembled officers, I noted with well-concealed amusement, were now breathing shallowly through their mouths. "My aide, Gunner First Class Ferrick Jürgen," I said. In truth, there was only one grade of gunner, but I didn't expect they'd know that, and the small unofficial promotion would add to whatever kudos he got from being the aide of a commissar, which in turn would reflect well on me. "Perhaps you could assign him some quarters." "Of course." She turned to one of the youngest lieutenants, a blonde girl of vaguely equine appearance who looked as if she'd been more at home on a farm somewhere than in uniform, and nodded. "Sulla, get the quartermaster to sort it out." "I'll do it myself," she replied, slightly overdoing the eager young officer routine. "Matthew's doing his best, but he's not quite on top of the system yet." Castine nodded blandly, unaware of any problem, but I could see Brocklaw's jaw tighten and noticed that most of the men present failed to mask their displeasure. "Sulla was our quartermaster sergeant until the last round of promotions," Castine explained. "She knows the ship's resources better than anyone." "I'm sure she does," I said diplomatically. "And I'm sure she has far more pressing duties to perform than finding a bunk for Jürgen. We'll liaise with your Sergeant Magill ourselves, if you have no objection." "None at all." Castine looked slightly puzzled for a moment, then dismissed it. Brocklaw, I noticed from the corner of my eye, was looking at me with something approaching respect now. Well, that was something at least. But it was pretty clear I was going to have my work cut out to turn this divided and demoralized rabble into anything resembling a fighting unit. Well, up to a point, anyway. If they were a long way from being ready to fight the enemies of the Emperor, they were certainly in good enough shape to fight amongst themselves, as I was shortly to discover. I haven't reached my second century by ignoring the little presentiments of trouble which sometimes appear out of nowhere, like those itching palms of mine, or the little voice in the back of my head which tells me something seems too good to be true. But in my first few days aboard the Righteous Wrath, I had no need of such subtle promptings from my subconscious. Tension hung in the air of the corridors assigned to us like ozone around a demon host, all but striking sparks from the bulkheads. And I wasn't the only one to feel it. None of the other regiments on board would venture into our part of the ship, either for social interaction or the time-honoured tradition of perpetrating practical jokes against the members of another unit. The naval provosts patrolled in tense, wary groups, desperate for some kind of respite. I even made courtesy calls on the other commissars aboard, but these were far from convivial. Humourless emperor botherers to a man. The younger ones were too overwhelmed by respect for my reputation to be good company, and most of the older ones were quietly resentful of what they saw as a glory-hogging young upstart. Tedious as these interludes were, though, I was to be grateful for them sooner than I thought. The one bright spot was Captain Pargita, who'd commanded the vessel for the past 30 years, and with whom I hit it off from our first dinner together. I'm sure he only invited me the first time because protocol demanded it, and perhaps out of curiosity to see what a hero of the Imperium actually looked like in the flesh. But by the time we were halfway through the first course, we were chatting away like old friends. I told a few outrageous lies about my past adventures, and he reciprocated with some anecdotes of his own. And by the time we'd got on to the Amasek, I felt more relaxed than I had in months. For one thing, he really appreciated the problems I was facing with Castine and her rabble. "You need to reassert some discipline," he told me unnecessarily, "before the rot spreads any further. Shoot a few. That'll buck their ideas up." Easy to say, of course, but not so easy in practice. That's what most commissars would have done, admittedly. But getting a regiment united because they're terrified of you and hate your guts has its own drawbacks, particularly as you're going to find yourself in the middle of a battlefield with these people before very long. And they'll all have guns. And, as I've already said, I had a reputation to maintain. And a good part of that was keeping up the pretense that I actually gave a damn about the troopers under my command. So, not an option, unfortunately. It was while I was on my way back to my quarters from one such pleasant evening that my hand was forced, and in a way I could well have done without. It was the noise that alerted me at first, a gradually swelling babble of voices from the corridors leading to our section of the ship. My pleasantly reflective mood, enhanced by Parjita's Amasek and a comfortable win over the regicide board, evaporated in an instant. I knew that sound all too well, and the clatter of boots on the deck behind me as a squad of provosts double-timed towards the disturbance with shock buttons drawn was enough to confirm it. I picked up my pace to join them, falling in beside the section leader. "Sounds like a riot," I said. The blank-visored head nodded.
"Quite right, sir."
Any idea what sparked it? Not that it mattered. The simmering resentment among the Valhallans was almost cause enough on its own. Any excuse would have done. If he did have a clue, I never got to hear it. As we arrived at the door of the mess hall, a ceramic cup bearing the regimental crest of the 296th shattered against his helmet. "Emperor's blood!" I ducked reflexively, taking cover behind the nearest piece of furniture to assess the situation while the provosts waded in ahead of me, striking out with their shock batons at any target that presented itself. The room was a heaving mass of angry men and women, punching, kicking, and flailing at one another. All semblance of discipline shot to hell. Several were down already, bleeding, screaming, being trampled on by the still-active combatants, and the casualties were rising all the time. The fiercest fighting was going on in the centre of the room, a small knot of brawlers, clearly intent on actual murder unless someone intervened. Fine by me. That's what the provosts were for. I hunkered down behind an overturned table, scanning the room as I voxed a situation report to Castine and watched them battle their way forward. The two fighters at the centre of the melee seemed evenly matched to me. A shaven-headed man, muscled like a catechan, who towered over a wiry young woman with short-cropped raven-black hair. Whatever advantage he had in strength, she could match in agility, striking hard and leaping back out of range, reducing most of his strikes to glancing blows, which is just as well, as a clean hit from those ham-like fists would likely have stove her ribcage in. As I watched, he spun, launching a lethal roundhouse kick to her temple. She ducked, just a fraction slow, and went sprawling as his foot grazed the top of her head, but twisted upright again with a knife from one of the tables in her hand. The blow came upwards towards his sternum, but he blocked it, opening up a livid red gash along his right arm. It was about then that things really started to go wrong. The provosts had made it almost halfway to the brawl I was watching when the two sides finally realized they had an enemy in common. A young woman, blood pouring from a broken nose, was unceremoniously yanked away from the man whose groin she'd been aiming a kick at and rounded on the provost, attempting to restrain her. Her elbow strike bounced harmlessly off his torso armour, but her erstwhile opponent leapt to her defence, swinging a broken plate in a short clinical arc which impacted precisely on the neck joint where helmet met flak. A bright crimson spurt of arterial blood sprayed the surrounding bystanders as the stricken provost dropped to his knees, trying to stem the bleeding. Emperor's bowels! I began to urge my way back towards the door to wait for the reinforcements Castine had promised. If they hadn't been before, the mob was in a killing mood now, and anyone who looked like a symbol of authority would become an obvious target. Even as I watched, both factions turned on the provosts in their midst, who disappeared under a swarm of bodies. The troopers barely seemed human anymore. I'd seen Tyranids move like that in response to a perceived threat, but this was even worse. Your average Nid swarm has purpose and intelligence behind everything it does, even though it's hard to remember that when a tidal wave of chitin is bearing down on you with every intention of reducing you to mincemeat. But it was clear that there was no intelligence working here, just sheer brute bloodlust. Emperor, damn it, I've seen cornate cults with more self-restraint than those supposedly disciplined guard troopers displayed in that mess hall. At least while they were ripping the provosts apart, they weren't likely to notice me. So I made what progress I could towards the door, ready to take command of the reinforcements as soon as they arrived. And I would have made it too, if the squad leader hadn't surfaced long enough to scream, "Commissar, help!" Oh, great. Every pair of eyes in the room suddenly swung in my direction. I thought I could see my reflection in every pupil, tracking me like an Auspex. "If you take one more step towards that door," I told myself, "you're a dead man." They'd be on me in seconds. The only way to survive was to take them by surprise. So I stepped forward instead, as though I'd just entered the room. "You," I pointed at a random trooper, "get a broom." Whatever they'd been expecting me to say or do, this definitely wasn't it. The room hung suspended in confused anticipation, the silence stretching for an infinite second. No one moved. "That was not a request," I said, raising my voice a little and taking another step forward. "This mess hall is an absolute disgrace, and no one is leaving until it's been tidied up." My boot skidded in a slowly congealing pool of blood. You, and you, go with him. Buckets and mops. Make sure you get enough to go round." Confusion and uncertainty began to spread, troopers flicking nervous glances at one another as it gradually began to dawn on them that the situation had got well out of hand and that consequences had to be faced. The guardsmen I'd pointed out, two of them women, began to edge nervously towards the door. "At the double!" I barked suddenly. With my best parade ground snap, the designated troopers scurried out, ingrained patterns of discipline reasserting themselves. And that was enough. The thunderstorm crackle of violence dissipated from the room as though suddenly earthed. After that, it was easy. Now that I'd asserted my authority, the rest fell into line as meek as you please, and by the time Castine arrived with another squad of provosts in tow, I'd already detailed a few more to escort the wounded and worse to the infirmary. A surprising number were able to walk, but there were still far too many stretcher cases for my liking. "You did well, I hear." Castine was at my elbow, her face pale as she surveyed the damage. I shrugged, knowing from long experience that credit snowballs all the faster the less you seem to want it. "Not well enough for some of these poor souls," I said. "Bravest thing I ever saw," I heard from behind me, as one of the injured provosts was helped away by a couple of his shipmates. "He just stood there and faced them down, the whole damn lot." His voice faded, adding another small increment to my heroic reputation, which I knew would be all round the ship by this time tomorrow. "There'll have to be an investigation." Castine looked stunned, still not quite capable of taking in the full enormity of what had happened. "We need to know who started it, what happened." "Who's to blame?" Brocklaw cut in from the door. It was obvious from the direction of his gaze where he thought the responsibility should lie. Castine flushed. "I've no doubt we'll discover the men responsible," she said, a faint but perceptible stress on the pronoun. Brocklaw refused to rise to the bait. "We can all thank the Emperor we have an impartial adjudicator in the Commissar here," he said smoothly. I'm sure we can rely on him to sort it out. Thanks a lot, I thought. But he was right, and how I handled it was to determine the rest of my future with the regiment, not to mention leaving me running for my life yet again, beginning a long and unwelcome association with the Emperor's pet psychopaths, and an encounter with the most fascinating woman I've ever met.
Not the most flattering or accurate description of His Divine Majesty's Most Holy Inquisition, it must be admitted.
Chapter 2. You get more with a kind word and an excruciator than with just a kind word. Inquisitor Mulden. So, what you're trying to tell me, I said, turning the piece of crockery over in my hand, is that 3 people are dead, 14 still in the infirmary, and a perfectly serviceable mess hall reduced to kindling because your men didn't like the plates they were served their meal on. Brocklaw squirmed visibly on one of the chairs I had Jürgen bring into my office for the conference. I told him to fetch the most uncomfortable ones he could find, as every little bit helps when you're trying to exert your authority. But the Major's discomfiture wasn't due to just that alone. Castine was still visibly suppressing a smirk, which I was planning to wipe away in a moment.
"Well, that may be overstating it a little," he began.
"That's precisely what happened," Castine cut in acidly. I hefted the plate. It was good quality porcelain, delicate but strong, and one of the few pieces remaining intact after the mess hall riot. The regimental crest of the 296th was prominent in the centre of it. I turned to the data slate on my desk and made a show of paging through the reports and witness statements I'd spent the past week collecting. According to this witness statement, the first punch was swung by a Corporal Bella Trebek, a member of the 296th prior to the amalgamation. I raised an inquisitive eyebrow in Castine's direction. Would the Colonel care to comment? She was clearly provoked, Castine said, losing the smirk, which seemed to hover in the air for a moment before jumping across to Brocklaw. Just so, I nodded judiciously, by a Sergeant Tobias Kelp, who, it says here, threw his plate down, declaring that he would be damned if he ate off some... I made a show of getting the quotation scrupulously correct. Mincing Tarts Front Parlour Tea Service. Does that strike you as a reasonable comment, Major? The smirk disappeared again. Not particularly, no, he said, clearly wondering where this line of questioning was going. But we still don't know the full circumstances.
I think the circumstances are perfectly clear, I said.
The former troopers of the 296th and the 301st have cordially detested one another since the regiments were amalgamated. Under the circumstances, the use of the 296th regimental dinner service was bound to be regarded as an insult by the stupider elements of the former 301st. Brocklaw flushed at that. Good. Let him get angry. The only way to salvage the situation was to make radical changes, and that wouldn't work unless I could get the senior officers to feel passionately that they were necessary. Which begs another question, I went on smoothly. Just who was stupid enough to order the use of the dinner service in the first place? I aimed my second best intimidating commissarial glare at Castine for a fraction of a second before snapping it round to nail the junior officer sitting at her right. Lieutenant Sulla, that would be you, would it not?
It was Founding Day, she retorted.
That did take me by surprise. I didn't often get people bouncing back from a number two glare, but I concealed it with the ease of long practice. We always use the regimental ceramics on Founding Day. It's one of our proudest traditions.
It was,
Brocklaw broke in with sardonic amusement.
But unless you've got some traditional adhesive...
Both women bristled. For a moment, I thought I was going to have to put down a brawl in my own office.
Major, I said, reasserting my authority, I'm sure the 301st had their own Founding Day traditions.
That was a pretty safe bet, as practically every regiment celebrated the anniversary of its first founding in some way. He began to nod, before my use of the past tense registered with him, and then an expression curiously close to apprehension flickered across his face. I leaned back in my chair, which, unlike theirs, I'd made sure was comfortably padded, and looked approving. It's always good to keep people off balance. I'm glad to hear it. Such traditions are important. A vital part of the esprit de corps we all rely on to win the Emperor his victories. Castine and Brocklaw nodded cautiously, almost together. Good. That was the one thing at least they could agree on. But Sula just flushed angrily.
Then perhaps you could explain that to Kelp and his knuckle-draggers, she said.
I sighed, tolerantly, and placed my las pistol on the desk. The officer's eyes widened slightly. Brocklaw's took on a wary expression, Castine's one of barely suppressed alarm, and Sula's jaw dropped open.
Please don't interrupt, Lieutenant, I said mildly. You can all have your say in a moment.
There was a definite edge in the room now. I had no intention of shooting anyone, of course, but they weren't going to like what I was about to say next, and you can't be too careful. I smiled to show I was harmless, and they relaxed a fraction. Nevertheless, you've just illustrated my point perfectly. While the two halves of this regiment still think of themselves as separate units, morale is never going to recover. That means you're sod-all use to the Emperor and a pain in the ass to me. I paused, just long enough to let them assimilate what I'd just said. Are we in agreement on that, at least? Castine nodded, meeting Brocklaw's eyes for the first time since the meeting began.
I think so, she said. The question is, what do we do about it?
Good question. I passed a slate across the desk. She took it, and Brocklaw leaned in to scan it over her shoulder as she read. We can start by integrating the units at squad level. As of this morning, every squad will consist of roughly equal numbers of troopers from each of the former regiments.
That's ridiculous, Brocklaw snapped, a fraction behind Castine's far from ladylike exclamation.
The men won't stand for it.
Neither will my women.
Castine nodded in agreement with him.
So far, so good. Making them feel they had common cause against me was the first step to getting them to cooperate properly.
They're going to have to, I said. This ship is en route to a potential war zone. We could be in combat within hours of our arrival, and when that happens, they'll have to rely on the trooper next to them, whoever it is. I don't want my people getting killed because they don't trust their own comrades. So they're going to train together and work together until they start behaving like an Imperial Guard regiment instead of a bunch of pre-scholar juvies. And they're going to fight the Emperor's enemies together, and I expect them to win. Is that clear?
Perfectly, Commissar. Castine's jaw was tight. I'll start reviewing the SO&E.
Slate of organization and equipment. Not actually a physical data slate, but an archaic term for the details of the disposition of troopers and equipment within an Imperial Guard unit, still in use among many regiments, with more than 1,000 years of unbroken tradition.
Perhaps it would be best if you did so with the Major's help, I suggested. Between you, you should be able to select fire teams which at least have a reasonable chance of turning their lasguns on the enemy instead of one another.
Of course, Brocklaw nodded. I'll be pleased to help.
The tone of his voice said otherwise, but at least the words were conciliatory. That was a start. But they really weren't going to like what was coming next. Which brings me on to the new regimental designation. I'd been expecting some outburst at this, but the trio of officers in front of me just stared in stupefied silence. I guess they were trying to convince themselves they hadn't heard what I'd just said. The current one just emphasizes the divisions between what used to be the 301st and the 296th. We need a new one, ladies and gentlemen. A single identity under which we can march into battle united and resolute as true servants of the Emperor.
All good stirring stuff, and for a moment I actually thought they were going to buy it without any further argument. But of course it was that daft Mayor Sula who burst the bubble.
"You can't just abolish the 296th," she almost shouted. "Our battle honours go back centuries. If you count slapping down stroppy colonists as battles,"
Brocklaw rose to the bait,
"the 301st has fought orcs, Eldar, Tyranids." "Oh, there were Tyranids on Karania. I guess I was just too busy with my needlepoint to notice."
Sula's voice rose another octave.
"Shut up, both of you."
Castine's voice was quiet but firm and stunned both her subordinates into silence. I nodded gratefully at her, forestalled from having to do the job myself, and pleasantly surprised. It was beginning to look as though she had the makings of an effective commander after all. "Let's hear what the Commissar has to say before we start inventing objections to it."
"Thank you, Colonel," I said before resuming. "What I propose is to treat the date of amalgamation as a new first founding. I've had the ship's astropath contact the Munitorium, and they've agreed in principle. There is currently no regiment designated the Valhallan 597th, so I've proposed adopting that as our new identity."
296 plus 301. "I see," Castine nodded. "Very clever."
Brocklaw nodded too.
A very neat way of preserving the identities of the old regiments," he said, "but combined into something new."
"As was always the intention," I agreed.
"But that's outrageous," Sula said. "You can't just redesignate an entire regiment out of existence."
"The Commissariat gives its servants wide discretionary powers," I said mildly. "How we interpret them is a matter of judgment, and sometimes temperament. Not every Commissar would have resisted the temptation to discourage further dissension in the ranks by decimation, for instance. Quite true, of course. There were damn few who'd go quite so far as to randomly execute 1 in 10 of the troopers under their command to encourage the others, but they did exist. And if ever a regiment was so undisciplined that such a drastic measure might have been justified, it was this one, and they knew it. They were just lucky they'd got Kane the Hero instead of some gung-ho psychopath. I've met one or two in my time, and the best thing you can say for them is that they don't tend to be around long, particularly once the shooting starts." I smiled to show I didn't mean it. "If the new designation is unacceptable," I added, "the 48th Penal Legion is also available, I'm told."
Sula blenched. Castine smiled tightly, unsure of how serious I was.
"The 597th sounds good to me," she said.
"Major Brocklaw?"
"An excellent compromise."
He nodded slowly, letting the idea percolate.
"There'll be some grumbling in the ranks, but if ever a regiment needed a new beginning, it's this one."
"Amen to that," Castine agreed. The two senior officers looked at one another with renewed respect. That was a good sign, too. Only Sula still looked unhappy. Brocklaw noticed and caught her eye.
"Cheer up, Lieutenant," he said. "That would make our next founding day..."
He paused fractionally, glancing at me for confirmation as he worked it out.
258.
I nodded.
"You'll have nearly 8 months to come up with some brand new traditions." Of course, the changes I'd imposed didn't go down too well with the rank and file, at least to begin with, and I got most of the blame. But then I've never expected to be popular. Ever since I got selected for commissarial training, I've known I could expect very little from the troopers around me, apart from resentment and suspicion. As my undeserved reputation has snowballed, of course, that's got to be the case less and less of the time, but back then I was still taking it more or less for granted. Gradually, though, the reorganization I'd insisted on began to work, and the training exercises we put the troopers through were beginning to make them think like soldiers again. I instituted a weekly prize of an afternoon's downtime for the most efficient platoon in the regiment, and a doubling of the ale rations for the members of the most disciplined squad within it, and that helped remarkably. I felt we'd really turned a corner the morning I overheard one of the new mixed squads chatting together in the freshly repainted mess hall, instead of splitting it into two separate groups, as they tended to do in the beginning, and exulting over their higher place in the rankings than a rival platoon. These days, I'm told, Kane's Round is a cherished tradition in the 597th, and the competition for the extra ration of ale still hotly contested. All in all, I suppose there are worse things to be remembered for. The one problem we still had to resolve, of course, was the matter of those responsible for the riots in the first place. Kelp and Trebek were for it. There was no doubt about that, along with a handful of others who had been positively identified as responsible for the worst of the deaths and injuries. But for the time being, I'd put off the question of punishment. The wholesale reforms I'd instigated and the subsequent improvement in morale were still fragile, and I didn't dare risk it by ordering executions. So I did what any sensible man in my position would have done. Dragged my feet under the pretext of carrying out a thorough investigation, kept the defaulters locked away where, with any luck, most of their comrades would forget about them in the general upheaval, and hoped something would turn up. It was a good plan. And it would have worked too, at least until we arrived in a war zone somewhere and I could quietly return them to a unit or have them transferred away with no one any the wiser, if it hadn't been for my good friend Captain Barjita. Technically, of course, he was well within his rights to demand copies of all the reports I'd been compiling, and I hadn't thought there was any harm in letting him have them. What I'd been forgetting was that the Righteous Wrath wasn't just a collection of corridors, bunkrooms, and training bays. It was his ship, and that he was the ultimate authority on board. Two of the dead had been his provosts, after all, and he wasn't about to sit back and let the perpetrators get away with it. He wanted a full court-martial of the guilty troopers while we were still on board, and he could make sure they were punished to his satisfaction. "I know you want to be thorough," he said one evening as we set up the regicide board in his quarters. "But frankly, Caiaphas, I think you're overdoing it. You already know who the guilty parties are. Just shoot them and have done with it." I shook my head regretfully. "But what would that solve?" I asked. "Would it bring your men back to life?" "That's not the point." He held out both fists, concealing playing pieces. I picked the left and found I was playing blue. A minor tactical disadvantage, but one I was sure I could overcome. "Regicide isn't really my game, to be honest. Give me a tarot deck and a table full of suckers with more money than sense any day, but it passed the time pleasantly enough." "There really can't be any other verdict, and every day you delay just leaves the cowardly scum cluttering up my brig, eating my food, breathing my air." He was getting quite emotional. I began to suspect that there had been more than a simple line of command relationship between him and one of the dead provosts.
"Kane is correct in this assumption. Strictly against regulations, of course, but boys will be boys."
"Believe me," I said, "there's nothing I'd like better than to draw a line under this whole sorry affair. But the situation's complicated. If I have them shot, the whole regiment could unravel again. Morale's just starting to recover."
I appreciate that," Pajita nodded, "but that's not my problem. I've got a crew to think about, and they want to see their comrades avenged."
He made his opening move. "I see." I moved one of my own pieces, playing for time in more senses than one. "Then it's clearly long past time that justice was served."
"Are you insane?"
Castine asked, looking at me across the desk and trying to ignore the hovering presence of Jürgen, who was shuffling some routine reports I couldn't be bothered to deal with.
"If you condemn the defaulters now, we'll be right back where we started. Trebek's very popular with the..."
She shot a quick glance at Brocklaw, seated next to her, and overrode the remark she'd been about to make.
"With some of the troopers."
"The same goes for Kelp." Brocklaw moved quickly to back her up. Exactly the reaction I'd been hoping for, now the regiment was beginning to function properly. Castine and Brocklaw had begun to slip into their roles of commander and executive officer as smoothly as if the bad feeling between them had never existed. Well, up to a point, anyway. There was still an air of strained politeness between them occasionally, which betrayed the effort, but they were well on the way. And, to be honest, it was far more than I could have hoped for when I stepped off the shuttle.
"I agree," I said. "Thank you, Jürgen."
My aide had appeared at my shoulder with a pot of tanner leaf tea, as was his habit whenever I was in my office at this time of the morning.
"Could you get another couple of bowls?"
"Of course, Commissar." He shuffled away as I poured my own drink and pushed the tray to the side of my desk. The warm, aromatic steam relaxed me as it always did.
"Not for me, thank you,"
Brocklaw said hastily as Jürgen returned, a fresh pair of tea bowls pinched together by a grubby finger and thumb on the inside of the rims. Castine blenched slightly, but accepted a drink anyway. She kept it on the desk in front of her, picking it up from time to time to punctuate her side of the conversation, but never quite getting round to taking the first sip. I was quietly impressed. She'd have made a good diplomat if she hadn't been so honest.
"The problem is," I went on, "the Captain Pargita is the ultimate authority aboard this ship, and he's well within his rights to insist on a court-martial. If we don't let him have one, he'll just invoke his command privilege and have Kelp and the others shot anyway, and we simply can't let that happen."
"So what do you suggest?" Castine asked, replacing the tea bowl after another almost sip.
"Regimental discipline is supposed to be your responsibility, after all."
"Precisely." I took a sip of my own tea, savouring the bitter aftertaste, and nodded judiciously. "And I've been able to convince him that I can't have that authority undermined if we're to become a viable fighting unit."
"You've got him to agree to some kind of compromise?"
Brocklaw asked, grasping the point at once.
"I have."
I tried not to sound too smug.
"He can have his court-martial and run it himself under naval regulations, but once they're found guilty, they'll be turned over to the commissariat for sentencing."
"But that takes us right back to where we were before," Castine said, clearly puzzled.
"You have them shot and discipline goes to the warp, again."
"Maybe not," I said, taking another sip of tea. "Not if we're careful." I've seen more than my fair share of tribunals over the years, even been in front of them on occasion, and if there's one thing I've learned, it's this. It's easy to get the result you want out of them. The trick is simply to state your case as clearly and concisely as possible. That, and making damn sure the members of it are on your side to begin with. There are a number of ways of ensuring that this is the case. Bribery and threats are always popular, but generally to be avoided, especially if you are likely to attract inquisitorial attention, as they're better at both and tend to resent other people resorting to their methods.
This is, of course, entirely untrue. As His Divine Majesty's most faithful servants, we're most definitely above such petty emotions as resentment.
Besides, that sort of thing tends to leave a residue of bad feeling, which can come back to haunt you later on. In my experience, it's far more effective to make sure that the other members of the panel are honest, unimaginative idiots with a strong sense of duty and a stronger set of prejudices you can rely on to deliver the result that you want. If they think you're a hero and hang on your every word, so much the better. So, when Pargita announced his verdict of guilty on all charges and turned to me with a self-satisfied smirk, I had my strategy worked out well in advance. The courtroom, a hastily converted wardroom generally used by the ship's most junior officers, went silent. There were 5 troopers in the dock by the time the trial had begun. Far fewer than Pargita had wanted, but in the interests of fairness and damage limitation, I had managed to persuade him to let me deal summarily with most of the outstanding cases. Those guilty of more minor offences had been demoted, flogged, or assigned to latrine duty for the foreseeable future and safely returned to their units, where, in the unfathomable processes of the trooper's mindset, I had somehow become the embodiment of justice and mercy. This had been helped along by a little judicious myth-making among the senior officers, who had let it be known that Pargita was hell-bent on mass executions, and that I had spent the past few weeks exerting every iota of my commissarial authority in urging clemency for the vast majority. finally succeeding against almost impossible odds. The net result, aided no end by my fictitious reputation, was that a couple of dozen potential troublemakers had been quietly integrated back into the roster. Practically grateful for the punishments they'd received, and morale had remained steady among the rank and file. The problem now facing me was that of the hardcore recidivists, who were undoubtedly guilty of murder or its attempt. There were five of them facing the courtroom now, wary and resentful. Three of them I recognized at once from the melee in the mess hall. Kelp was the huge, over-muscled man I'd seen being stabbed, and Trebek, to my complete lack of surprise, was the petite woman who had almost disemboweled him. They stood at opposite ends of the row of prisoners, glaring at one another almost as much as at Pargita and myself, and if it hadn't been for their manacles, I had no doubt they'd be at one another's throats again in a heartbeat. In the centre was the young trooper I'd seen stab the provost with a broken plate. His data file told me his name was Thomas Hollenby, and I'd had to look twice to make sure it was the same man. He was short and skinny, with untidy red hair and a face full of freckles, and he'd spent most of the trial looking bewildered and on the verge of tears. If I hadn't seen his fit of homicidal rage for myself, I would hardly have believed him capable of such insensate violence. The real irony was that he was a medical orderly, not a frontline soldier at all. Between him and Trebek was another female trooper, one Griselda Vallade. She was stocky, brunette, and clearly out of her depth as well. The only one of the group to have killed a fellow trooper, she had claimed throughout that she'd only intended to fend him off. It was an unlucky blow that had crushed the fellow's larynx and left him to suffocate on the mess room floor. Pargita, needless to say, hadn't bought it, or cared whether she intended murder or not. He just wanted as many Valhallans in front of a firing squad as he could manage. On Hollenby's other side was Maxim Sorrel, a tall, rangy man with short blonde hair and the cold eyes of a killer. Sorrel was a sharpshooter, a long-las specialist, who snuffed out lies from a distance as dispassionately as I might swat an insect. Of all of them, he was the one who most threw a scare into me. The others had been carried away by the bloodlust of a mob and hadn't really been responsible for their actions past a certain point, but Sorrel had slid a knife through the joints of a provost's body armour simply because he hadn't seen any reason not to. The last time I'd looked into eyes like those, they'd belonged to an elder homunculus. "If it was up to me," Pargita said, continuing, "I would have the lot of you shot at once." I glanced down the line of prisoners again and noted their reactions. Kelp and Trebek glared defiantly back at him, daring him to make good on the threat. Hollenby blinked and swallowed rapidly. Vallade gasped audibly, biting her lower lip, and began to hyperventilate. To my surprise, I saw Hollenby reach across and give her hand a reassuring squeeze. Then again, they'd been in adjoining cells for weeks now, so I suppose they'd had time to get to know each other. Sorrel simply blinked, a complete lack of emotional response that sent shivers down my spine. "Nevertheless," the captain went on, "Commissar Kane has been able to persuade me that the commissariat is better suited to maintaining discipline among the Imperial Guard, and has requested that they be permitted to pass sentence according to military rather than naval regulations." He nodded cordially to me. "Commissar, they're all yours." Five pairs of eyes swiveled in my direction. I stood slowly, glancing down at the data slate on the table in front of me. "Thank you, Captain." I turned to the trio of black uniformed figures sitting at my side. "And thank you, Commissars. Your advice in this case has been invaluable to me." Three solemn heads nodded in my direction. This was the trick, you see. My earlier contact with the other commissars on board had unexpectedly paid off, showing me who would be the most easily swayed by my arguments. A couple of eager young pups just past cadet, and a jaded old campaigner who had lived most of his life on the battlefield, and all of them flattered from here to Terra to be taken into the confidence of the celebrated Caiaphas Kane. I turned back to the prisoners. "A commissar's duty is often harsh," I said. "Regulations are there to be obeyed and discipline to be enforced.
and those regulations do indeed prescribe the ultimate penalty for murder, unless there are extenuating circumstances. Circumstances, I have to admit, I have striven to find in this case to the best of my abilities. I had them all on the hook by now. The fans in the ceiling ducts sounded almost as loud as a Chimera engine. And to my great disappointment, I have been unsuccessful. There was an audible intake of breath from practically every pair of lungs present. Pargita grinned triumphantly, sure he'd got the blood vengeance he lusted after. However, I went on after a fractional pause. A faint frown appeared on the captain's face and a flicker of hope on Valade's. As my esteemed colleagues will undoubtedly agree, one of the heaviest burdens a commissar must carry is the responsibility to ensure that the regulations are obeyed not only in the letter, but the spirit. And it was with that in mind that I took the liberty of consulting with them about a possible interpretation of those regulations which I felt might offer a solution to my dilemma. I turned dramatically to the little group of commissars, taking the opportunity to underline that it wasn't just me cheating Pargita out of his firing squad, it was the commissariat itself. Again, gentlemen, I thank you. Not only on my behalf, but on behalf of the regiment I have the honour to serve with. I turned to Castine and Brocklaw, who were observing proceedings from the side of the courtroom, and inclined my head to them too. I was laying it on with a trowel, I don't mind admitting it, but I've always enjoyed being the centre of attention when that doesn't involve incoming fire. A commissar's primary concern must always be the efficiency of the unit to which he is attached, I said, and by extension the battlefield effectiveness of the entire Imperial Guard. It's a heavy responsibility, but one we are proud to bear in the Emperor's name. The other commissars nodded in sycophantic self-congratulation. And that means that I'm always loath to sacrifice the life of a trained soldier, whatever the circumstances, unless it's the only way to win His Glorious Majesty the victories he requires. I assume that you're eventually going to come to a point of some kind, Pargita interrupted. I nodded, as though he'd done me a favour, instead of disrupting the flow of an oration I'd been practising in front of the mirror in my stateroom for most of the morning. "Indeed I am," I said. "And the point is this. My colleagues and I..." No harm in reminding everyone again that this was a carefully contrived consensus, not just me. "See no point in simply executing these troopers. Their deaths will win us no victories." "But the regulations," Pargita began. This time it was my turn to cut him off in full flow. "Specify death as the punishment for these offences. It just doesn't specify immediate death." I turned to the line of confused and apprehensive prisoners. "It's the judgment of the commissariat that you all be confined until it becomes expedient to transfer you to a penal legion where an honourable death on the battlefield will almost certainly befall you in the fullness of time. In the interim, should a particularly hazardous assignment become available, you will have the honour of volunteering. In either case, you can expect the opportunity to redeem yourselves in the eyes of the Emperor." I raked my eyes along the shabby little group again. Kelp and Trebek, their truculence mitigated by surprise, Hollenby still bewildered by the sudden turn of events, Valade almost sobbing with relief, and Sorrel still that blank expression, as though none of this mattered at all. "Dismissed!" I waited until they'd shuffled out, assisted by the shock batons of the escorting provosts, and turned back to Pargita. "Will that satisfy you, Captain?" "I suppose it'll have to," he said sourly. "Congratulations, Commissar." Castine raised a glass of Amasek, toasting my victory, and the mess hall erupted around me. I smiled modestly, walking towards the table occupied by the senior officers, while men and women clapped and cheered and chanted my name, and generally carried on as though I was the Emperor himself dropping in for a visit.
I half expected some of them to try patting me on the back, but respect for my position, or an understandable reluctance to get too close to Jürgen, who was dogging my heels as usual, or both, held them in check. I held up my hands for silence as I reached my seat between Castine and Brocklaw, and the room gradually fell quiet. "Thank you, all," I said, injecting just the right level of barely perceptible quaver into my voice to suggest powerful emotion held narrowly in check. "You do me too much honour for just doing my job." A chorus of denial and adulation followed, as I'd known it would. I waved them to silence again. "Well, if you insist." I waited for the gale of laughter to die down. "While I have everyone's attention, and that's a refreshing novelty for a political officer..." More laughter. I had them in the palm of my hand now. I waved them to silence again, adopting a slightly more serious mien. "I would just like to offer some congratulations of my own. In the short time I've had the privilege of serving with this regiment, you have all far exceeded my most optimistic expectations. The past few weeks have been difficult for all of us, but I can state with confidence that I have never served with a body of troops more ready for combat and more capable of seizing victory when that time comes." With confidence? Certainly. Truthfully? That was another matter entirely, but it had the desired effect. I picked up a glass from the table and toasted the room. "To the 597th, a glorious beginning." "The 597th!" they all shouted, men and women alike, swept along with cheap emotion and cheaper rhetoric. "Nicely done, Commissar," Brocklaw murmured as I sat. The cheers were still deafening. "I believe you've turned us into a proper regiment at last." I'd done something a lot more important than that, of course. I'd established myself as a popular figure among the common troopers, which meant they'd watch my back if I was ever careless enough to find myself anywhere near the actual combat zone. Pulling them together into an effective fighting force was just a useful bonus. "Just doing my job," I said as modestly as I could, which is what they all expected, of course, and they lapped it up. "And not before time," Castine added. I kept my features carefully composed, but felt my good mood begin to evaporate. "We've had our orders?" Brocklaw asked. The colonel nodded, picking at a Radovan salad. "Some backwater dirt ball called Gravelax."
"Never heard of it," I said.
Editorial note. Given Kane's complete and typical lack of interest in anything that doesn't concern him directly, the following extract may prove useful in placing the rest of his narrative in a wider context. It must be said that the book from which it comes isn't the most reliable of guides to the campaign as a whole, but it does, unlike most studies of the Gravelax incident, at least attempt to sketch in the historical background to the conflict. Despite the author's obvious limitations as a chronicler of events, his summing up of the casus belli is substantially correct. From Purge the Guilty, an impartial account of the liberation of Gravelax, by Stententious Logar, 085.M42.
The seeds of the Gravelax incident were sown many years before the full magnitude of the crisis was realized, and in retrospect it may well be easy to discern the slow unfolding of an abhuman conspiracy over the span of several generations. A historian, however, has the perspective of hindsight, which, alas, cannot be said of the actual participants. So, rather than pointing an accusatory finger with righteous cries of "How could they have been so stupid?", it behooves us more to shake our heads in pity as we contemplate our forebears blind stumbling into the very brink of destruction. It goes without saying that no blame can be attached to the servants of the Emperor, particularly those concerned with the ordering of His Divine Majesty's fighting forces and the diligent adepts of the Administratum. The Ultima Segmentum is vast, and the Damocles Gulf an obscure frontier sector. After the heathen Tau were put in their place by the heroic Crusader fleet in the early 740s, attention rightly shifted to more immediate threats. The incursion of High Fleet Leviathan, the awakening of the accursed Necrons, and the ever-present danger from the traitor legions, not least among them. Nevertheless, the Tau presence remained on the fringes of Imperial space, and, all but unnoticed, they began once again to encroach on His Divine Majesty's blessed dominions. Up until this point, Gravelux had been an obscure outpost of civilization, barely noticed by the wider galaxy. Enough of its land masses were fertile to keep its relatively sparse population tolerably well fed, and it possessed adequate mineral reserves for such industry as it supported. In short, it had nothing to attract any trade, and an insufficient population base to be worth tithing for the Imperial Guard. It was, to be blunt, a backwater, devoid of anything of interest. If Gravelax thought it was to remain undisturbed indefinitely, however, it was sadly mistaken. Within a century of their drubbing at the righteous hands of the servants of the Imperium, the black-hearted Tau were back, spreading their poisonous heresies through the Gulf once more. When they first chanced upon Gravelax, no one knows, but by the turn of the last century of the millennium, they were well established there.
837.M41, according to surviving records. Like many amateur historians, Logar is long on rhetoric and short on actual scholarship.
It will come as no surprise to my readers, aware as we must be of the innate treachery of all aliens, that they had arrived at this pass by an insidious process of infiltration, and, shocking though it is to record it, with the willing assistance of those whose greed and thoughtlessness made them the perfect dupes of this monstrous conspiracy. I refer, as you have no doubt already guessed, to the so-called rogue traders. Rogues indeed, who would place their own interests above those of the Imperium, humanity, and the Divine Emperor himself.
Several paragraphs of inflammatory but non-specific denunciation of rogue traders omitted. Logar seems to have had something of an obsession about their untrustworthiness. Perhaps one owed him money.
How and why these pariahs of profit first began trafficking with the Tau, history does not record.
Or Logar couldn't be bothered to do the research.
What is certain is that Gravelax, with its isolated position on the fringes of Imperial space and close to the expanding sphere of influence of these malign aliens, became the perfect meeting place for such clandestine exchanges. Inevitably, the corruption spread. As trade increased, it became more open, with Tau vessels becoming a common sight at the new and expanding starports. Tau themselves began to be seen on the streets of the Gravelaxian cities, mingling with the populace, tainting their human purity with their soulless alien ways. Heresy began to run rife, even ordinary citizens daring to use blasphemous devices, unblessed by the tech priests, supplied by their insidious off-world allies. Something had to be done. And at last it was. The rising stench of corruption eventually attracted the ceaseless vigilance of the Inquisition, which lost no time in demanding the dispatch of a task force of the Imperium's finest warriors to purge this festering boil in the body of His Holiness's blessed domain. And that's precisely what they got. For in the vanguard of this glorious endeavour was none other than Caiaphas Kane, the martial hero at whose very name the enemies of humanity trembled in terror. Chapter 3. Old friends are like debt collectors. They have a tendency to turn up when you least expect them. Gilbran Quayle, Collected Essays. As I've rattled around the galaxy, I've seen a great many cities, from the soaring spires of Holy Terror itself to the blood-choked gutters of some Eldar Reaver charnel pit, but I've seldom seen anything stranger than the broad thoroughfares of Myo, the planetary capital of Gravelax.
Kane was part of the invasion force which cleansed Sanguir. His account of this action is also recorded in the archive.
We disembarked in good order, the freshly sewn banner of the 597th snapping proudly in the breeze that blew in gently across the rock-crete hectares of the starport as the Valhallans formed up by company,
and I resisted the temptation to lean across and compliment Sula on her needlepoint. I doubt that she'd had anything to do with procuring it, but it wasn't that which dissuaded me. She just wasn't the kind to take a joke, and was still harbouring a germ of resentment at the organisational changes I'd instituted. We were a fine sight to behold, I have to admit, the other regiments glancing at us sidelong as they marched away, although that may just have been surprise when they realised we're a mixed unit.
It was hardly unprecedented for men and women to serve together in the Imperial Guard. Notable units in which this was the norm included the Omicron Rangers, Tanith First, and Calderon Rifles. However, with women making up fewer than 10% of the total number under arms, and the vast majority of those serving in single-sex regiments, it wouldn't be that surprising if the 597th excited a certain amount of curiosity among the onlookers present.
All present and accounted for, Colonel. Brocklaw snapped a drill manual salute and fell into place beside Castine. She nodded, inflated her chest, and then hesitated on the verge of giving the command. Commissar, she said, I think the honour should be yours. This regiment wouldn't even exist if it wasn't for you. I don't mind admitting I was touched. Although I have overall authority in whatever unit I'm attached to, commissars are always outside the regular chain of command, which means I don't really fit in anywhere. By letting me give the order to move out, she was demonstrating in the most practical form imaginable that I was as much a part of the 597th as herself, or Brocklaw, or the humblest latrine orderly. The unaccustomed sense of belonging choked me for a moment, before the more rational part of my mind started gloating about how much that would mean in facilitating my own survival. I nodded, making sure I looked suitably moved. Thank you, Colonel, I said simply. But I believe the honour belongs to us all. Then I filled my chest and bellowed, Move out! So we did. And if you think that sounds like a simple proposition, you haven't thought it through. To put it into some kind of perspective, a regiment consists of anything up to half a dozen companies, five in our case, most of which had four or five platoons. The exception was Third Company, which was our logistical support arm and consisted mainly of transport vehicles, engineering units, and anything else we couldn't find a sensible place for on the SO&E. All told, that came to much the same thing in a headcount. Factor in five squads a platoon at 10 troopers each, plus a command element to keep them all in line, and you're looking at nearly 1,000 people by the time you've added in the various specialists and the different layers of the overall command structure. Just to add to the confusion, Castina decided to split the squads into five-man fire teams, anticipating that any open conflict was likely to take place in and around the urban areas. Beating off the Tyranids on Karania had convinced her that smaller formations were easier to coordinate in a city fight than full-strength squads.
A widespread, though unofficial practice among units experienced in urban warfare, so much so that it's now become part of the standard operating procedure in many regiments, the ad hoc arrangement persisting to become a permanent feature of their organisation.
All this made for a fine martial display as we moved out, you can be sure, with banners flying and the band thumping and parping away at If I Should Forget Thee, O Terror, as though they had a grudge against the composer. There hadn't really been time for rehearsals, what with all the excitement aboard the Righteous Wrath, but they were making up in enthusiasm for whatever they lacked in proficiency, and a high old time was being had by all. It was a fine, fresh day, with a faint taste of salt in the breeze from the nearby ocean, at least until our chimeras and transport trucks started up and began farting promethium fumes into the air. We intended to make an impression with our arrival, and by the Emperor we surely did, setting out to march the 10 kloms or so into the city.
Kloms is a Valhallan slang abbreviation for kilometre. Kane served with Valhallan units for most of his life, and almost inevitably his speech became peppered with colloquialisms acquired from them.
Most of the troopers were glad of the exercise, revelling in the fresh air and sunshine after so long between decks, and swung along the highways, lasguns at the slope. Being an old hive boy myself, it was all one to me. But I was affected by the general holiday atmosphere, I think, and I don't mind admitting to a general diffused glow of well-being as we got underway. Castine and Brocklaw couldn't march, of course, having to look grander than the common ground-pounders, and so trundled along at the front of the regiment in a salamander, and I seized the excuse to do the same. "Can't have the regiment's most vital officers plotting behind my back," I'd said at the briefing, smiling to show I didn't mean it, and pouring everyone a fresh cup of recaf to show I was part of the team. So I lounged back in the open compartment at the rear of a scout variant, which Jürgen kept half a track's length behind theirs in the interest of protocol, and reinforcing the impression of my generally assumed modesty, and took the opportunity to feel rather pleased with myself. The synchronized slapping of 2,000 boot soles on the surface of the highway and the squawking of the band almost drowned out the throb of our engine, and we must have looked a splendid sight as we left the main cargo gate of the starport behind us and began to approach the city. It was then that my palms began to itch again. There was nothing I could put my finger on initially to explain my gradually intensifying sense of disquiet, but something was definitely tapping my subconscious on the shoulder and whispering, "That's not right." As we entered the city itself, my disquiet grew. I wasn't surprised to find the streets free of traffic, the local authorities having cleared the way for us. 1,000 troopers and their ancillary equipment take up a lot of room, and we were far from the first regiment to have disembarked. Indeed, the occasional muffled curse from behind me, which cut through the din, made it all too clear that the front few ranks would have preferred it if the rough riders could have been held back for a while longer, instead of being sent through immediately ahead of us. Come to that, I don't suppose Castine was too thrilled about having to gaze at a street's width of horse arses for the duration of our march either. But the broad thoroughfares were a little too quiet for my liking, and a little too open as well. I'm not agoraphobic by any means, not like some hivers who never feel comfortable under an open sky, but there was something about those wide streets that made me think of snipers and ambush. That made me scan the buildings as we passed, and my unease grew the more I saw of them. There was nothing wrong with them as such, not like the bizarre architectural forms of a chaos incursion which seemed to twist reality and which hurt to look upon, or the brutal slapdash functionalism of orcish habitations, but there was something in their sweeping forms which seemed vaguely inhuman. I was put in mind of some Eldar architecture by their elegant simplicity. And then it finally hit me. There were no right angles anywhere, even the corners having been rounded and smoothed. But beneath this strange styling, the shapes were clearly those of warehouses, apartment blocks, and manufactoria, as though the whole city had been left out in the sun for too long and had started to melt. That alone should have been enough warning of an insidious alien influence at work here. But before we reached our destination, I was to see far more than that. "There's something seriously wrong here," I said to Jürgen, who looked up briefly from the road ahead to nod in agreement with me. "Something doesn't smell right," he agreed, without a trace of irony. "Have you seen the civilians?" Now that he came to mention it, there were remarkably few of them lining the route. Normally, a big military parade would have brought them out in droves, waving their Aquila flags and their icons of the Divine One, cheering themselves hoarse to see so many of the Emperor's finest ready to see off the foes so they could scuttle back to their meaningless lives without the fear of having to fight for themselves. But the pavements were half empty. And for every shopkeeper or habwife or juvie who cheered and waved, or smiled wanly at us with sidelong glances at their neighbours, there were just as many who scowled or glared at us. That put a shiver down my spine, awakening uncomfortable and all too recent memories of the mess hall riot and the blood-maddened troopers a hair from turning on me. At least no one was shouting or throwing things, yet. But I reached down unobtrusively and loosened my las pistol and my trusty chainsword, ready to be drawn in a hurry if I needed them. And right on cue, I noticed the first of the banners. "Murderers, go home," it said, in shaky capitals, hand-lettered on what looked like an old bedsheet. Someone had strung it from a luminator pole so that it hung out across the street, comfortably above head height, but low enough to brush irritatingly over the head and shoulders of anyone riding in a vehicle. Or on a horse, for that matter. As I watched, one of the Rough Rider officers reached up irritably and tore it down. Bad move, I said to myself, expecting some trouble from the crowd. But beyond a little catcalling from a small knot of juvies, nothing happened. But I was getting a distinctly uncomfortable feeling about all of this. There was a perceptible undercurrent of tension in the air now, like a fainter echo of the incipient violence I'd felt aboard the Righteous Wrath.
"Go back to your Emperor and leave us alone!"
a pretty girl shouted, her head shaven, apart from a single shoulder-length braid, and I felt as though I'd been doused with cold water. "Your Emperor." The words had been unmistakable.
"Heretics," Jürgen said with loathing.
I nodded, still unable to credit it. Could the great enemy have a foothold here as well as the Tau? But common sense argued against it. If that were the case, we'd have bombarded the place from orbit, surely, and the Astartes would have been sent in to cut out the cancer before it could spread. Things weren't as far gone as I'd feared, however. As I turned back to look, a squad of Arbetes forced their way through the crowd and began laying into the juvies with shock buttons. Good order was still being maintained here by the Emperor's grace, but for how much longer? That, I very much feared, depended on us. We reached our staging area without further incident, fanning out through a complex of warehouses and manufactoria which had been set aside for our use. We weren't the only regiment quartered there, I recall, as the Imperium had been fortifying against an expected incursion by the Tau for some time, and I gathered that the Righteous Wrath's complement, 3 full regiments apart from our own, brought the total up to around 30,000 all told. That should have been more than enough to keep a backwater planet even spread out across the whole globe, but rumour had it we could expect still more reinforcement, which worried me more than I wanted to show. With that amount of build-up, it seemed the aliens wanted this place quite badly, and we'd more than likely be expected to hold it the hard way. We were quartered next to one of the Valhallan armoured regiments, the 14th, I think, but I couldn't tell you who most of the others were. There was definite evidence that the Rough Riders were still somewhere in the vicinity there, so you had to watch your feet. But apart from that, I hadn't a clue. Except for one other unit I already knew well, of course, which I'll come to in a moment. I was still feeling spooked from our journey through town, so I was relieved to come across Brocklaw posting sentries around our corner of the compound as I left Jürgen to sort out my quarters and went for a wander around to get my bearings. I haven't reached my second sentry by not knowing where the best bolt holes and lines of retreat are, and finding them was always a high priority for me whenever I found myself somewhere new. "Good thinking, Major," I complimented him, and he gave me a wry grin. "We should be safe enough here," he said, "but it never hurts to be careful." "I know what you mean," I agreed. "There's something about this place which really gets under my skin." The warehouses around us all had that peculiar rounded-off look I'd noticed before, and the subtle sense of wrongness left a vague apprehension hovering around me like Jürgen's body odour. The Major knew his business, though, setting up las cannon in sandbagged emplacements to cover the gaps between the buildings around us, and sharpshooters on the roof. I was just admiring his thoroughness when the ground began to shake, and a couple of our sentinels appeared, clanking and humming and swivelling their heavy multi-lasers as they took up position in front of the main loading doors, which gave access to the ground floor where our vehicles were parked. Somewhat reassured by this, I made my way across the compound, passing into areas controlled by other units, watching the familiar bustle of troopers coming and going, and finding the familiar air of controlled chaos and the constant background hum of vehicle engines and profanity curiously soothing. I wasn't quite sure how far I'd gone when an engine note both louder and deeper than the others cut through the babble of sound around me. For a moment, I was assailed by that formless sense of recognition that you get
when something you once knew so well it never registered consciously comes back to your notice after a passage of years. And then I turned my head with a nostalgic smile. A Trojan heavy hauler, with an Earthshaker howitzer in tow, was growling its way across a vast open area which had probably once been used to park the private vehicles of the workers who toiled here in happier times, but which was now choked with equipment and supplies. I hadn't seen one of those up close in a long time, but I recognised it at once, having started my long and inglorious career in an obscure artillery unit. The flood of memories the sight brought back, a few of them even pleasant, was so overwhelming that for a moment I was unaware of the voice calling my name.
Kai! Over here!
Now, I've never been what you'd call oversupplied with friends. It goes with the job, I suppose. But of the few I've acquired over the years, only one has ever had the presumption to use the familiar form of my given name. So, despite the changes that the years since I'd seen him last had wrought, there was no mistaking the officer who was running across the compound towards me, grinning like an idiot.
Torren!
I called back as he sidestepped another Trojan, just in time to avoid being squashed into the tarmac like a bug.
When did they make you a major?
The last time I'd seen Torren Devis, he'd just been made captain, and was nursing a hangover as he saw me off from the 12th Field Artillery. I remember thinking at the time he was probably the only man in the battery who was sorry to see me go.
And what in the name of the Emperor's arse are you doing here?
The same as you, I suppose. He came panting up to me, the familiar lopsided grin on his face.
Keeping order? Purging the heretics? Same old thing.
There were streaks of grey at his temples now, I noticed, and his belt was out another notch, but the same air of boyish enthusiasm still hung around him as on the day we'd first met.
Well, I'm surprised to find you in a backwater like this.
Same here, I said. I turned my head, taking in the bustle surrounding us. This seems like an awful lot of firepower to put the frighteners on a bunch of stroppy provincials.
If the tower mobilised, we'll need every bit of it, Devis said. Some of their war gear has to be seen to be believed. They've got these things like dreadnoughts, but they're fast, like Astartes infantry, but twice the size, and their tanks make the Eldar stuff look like they were built by orcs.
As usual, he seemed to be relishing the prospect of combat, which is easy to do when you're kilometres behind the front line, chucking shells into the distance, but not so much fun when you're facing an enemy close enough to spit at you. And if that's all they've got in mind, think yourself lucky, unless they're one of those emperor-forsaken xenos that come equipped with venom sacks.
But it won't come to that, surely, I said. Now we're here, they'd be mad to attempt a landing.
To my astonishment, Devis laughed.
They won't have to. They're already here.
This was new and unwelcome information, and I goggled at him in surprise.
Since when?
I gasped. Now, I'd be the first to admit that I'm seldom that diligent when it comes to reading the briefing slates, but I was sure I'd have noticed something that crucial to my well-being in my cursory glance through it.
Devis shrugged. About 6 months, apparently. They were already deployed on the planet when the cleansing flame dropped us off here 3 weeks ago.
This was seriously bad news. I'd been looking forward to a nice brisk round of target practice on civilian rioters, or, at worst, a turkey shoot against the old renegade PDF unit. But now we were facing a foe that could give us a real run for our money. Emperor's bowels. If half of what I'd heard about the Tau and their techno-sorcery was true, we could be the ones getting our asses kicked. Devis grinned at my expression, misinterpreting it entirely.
"So you could see some fun after all,"
he said, clapping me on the back. I could have killed him. I didn't, of course. For one thing, as I've said, I don't have so many friends that I can afford to waste them. And for another, Devis had been here long enough to pick up some vital information which I currently lacked, namely the location of the nearest bar we could go to without attracting too much attention to ourselves." So we set out through the streets of Mayo together, my commissar's uniform getting us through the guard on the compound gate without any argument, although he did give us a word of caution.
"Be careful, sir. There's been disturbances up in the heights, they say."
The Heights were the most affluent area of the city, where it began to rise up into the surrounding hills. Though Tao influence on the local architecture was widespread, as Kane notes elsewhere, it was more overt here than anywhere else in Mayo. As a result, it was popular with the most radical of the pro-Tao citizens, and a natural focus of protest for the imperial loyalists. As the political situation continued to deteriorate, clashes between the two factions became commonplace here.
That meant nothing to me, so I smiled and nodded, and said we'd be careful, and checked with Divas that we'd be going nowhere near there as soon as we were out of earshot.
"Good Emperor, no," he said, frowning. "It's crawling with heretics. The only way you'd catch me up there is with a squadron of hellhounds to cleanse the place."
Needless to say, he'd never seen what incendiary weapons can do to a man, or he wouldn't have been half so keen on the idea.
"I have, and I wouldn't wish it on my worst enemy. Actually, there are one or two I would wish it on, come to think of it, and sit there happily toasting carbon nuts while they screamed, but they're all dead now anyway, so it's beside the point."
"So, where did they all come from?" I asked as we made our way through the streets. Dusk was falling now, the luminators and the cafe signs flickering to life, and the swirl of bodies around us growing thicker as the night descended. Small knots of passers-by stood aside to let us pass, intimidated no doubt by our imperial uniforms and the visible sidearms we carried, some with respect and others resentful. Several of the latter had the curious tonsure the heretic Juvie had sported, their heads shaved except for a long scalp lock. The significance of it wasn't to dawn on me until some time later, but even then I realized it was a badge of allegiance of some kind, and that those who bore it were liable to turn traitor if the shooting started. For now, though, they were content merely to mutter insults under their breath.
"They're local," Davis said, not deigning to notice them, which was fine by me.
Of all the ways I could have ended up dead over the years, getting sucked into a pointless street brawl would have been among the most embarrassing. The whole planet's infested with Xenolovers. A bit of an exaggeration, that, but he was more or less right, as I was later to discover. To cut a long story short, the Locusts had been trading with the Tao for several generations by now, which wasn't terribly sensible, but what can you expect from a bunch of backwater peasants? The end result was that most of them were quite used to seeing Xenos around the place, and, despite the sterling efforts of the local ecclesiarchy to warn them that no good would come of it, a lot of them had started to absorb unhealthy ideas from them, which was where we came in, ready to guide them back into the Imperial fold before they came to too much harm. And all very noble of us, too, I'm sure you'll agree. "The trouble is," Divas concluded, downing the rest of his third Amasek in one, "the hardcore are so far gone they don't see it like that. They think the Tower the best thing to hit the galaxy since the Emperor was in nappies, and we're the big bad bullies come here to take their shiny new toys away."
"Well, that might be a little more difficult now the Tao are digging in," I said, "but I'm surprised they're prepared to risk it."
I followed suit, feeling the smoky liquor warming its way down through my chest.
"They must know we'll never allow them to annex the place without a fight."
"They claim they're just here to safeguard their trading interests," Divas said. We both snorted with laughter at that one. We knew how often the Imperium had said exactly the same thing before launching an all-out invasion of some luckless ball of dirt. Of course, when we did it, it was true, and it was my job to shoot anyone who thought otherwise.
"One for the diplomats, then," I said, signalling for another round.
A nicely rounded waitress bustled over, full of patriotic fervour, and replenished our glasses. "One thing I can say for Divas, he knew how to find a good bar. This one, the Eagle's Wing, was definitely in the Loyalist camp. The wide, smoky cellar full of Planetary Defence Force regulars were delighted to see some real soldiers at last, and fulminating at the Governor for not letting them loose on the aliens years ago. The owner was a corporal in the PDF Reserves, recently retired after 20 years' service, and he couldn't seem to get over the honour of having a couple of real guard officers in the place. And once Divas introduced me, and I'd been appropriately modest about my earlier adventures in the Emperor's name, there was no question of us having to pay the bill either. After signing autographs for some of the civilian customers, all of whom urged us to pot a few of the little blue bastards on their behalf,
and charming the waitress had begun to poll, we'd retreated to a quiet side booth where we could talk uninterrupted. "I think the diplomats could be getting a little help on this one," Divas said, tapping the side of his nose conspiratorially as he lifted the glass. I drank a little more slowly, acutely aware that we'd have to start making our way back through a potentially hostile city soon, and wanting to keep a reasonably clear head.
"Help from who?" I asked.
"Who do you think?" Divas dipped his finger in the glass and sketched a stylized letter I with a pair of crossbars bisecting it on the surface of the table, before erasing it with a sweep of his hand. I laughed.
"Oh, yeah, them, right.
I've yet to arrive any place where the political situation's fluid without hearing rumours of Inquisition agents beavering away behind the scenes, and unless I happen to be the errand boy in question, I never believe a word of it. On the other hand, if there aren't any rumours, then they probably are up to some mischief and no mistake about it."
A reasonable assumption on both accounts. Details of Kane's subsequent activities as my errand boy, as he puts it, can be found in the Ordo's Librum, if any readers care to check the official accounts. His own version of these events can be found elsewhere in the archive, but need not concern us at the moment.
"You can laugh," Divas finished his drink and replaced the glass on the table. "But I heard it from one of the Administratum adepts, who swore he'd got it from... somewhere or other." An expression of faint bewilderment drifted across his face. "I think I need some fresh air."
"I think you do too," I said, leaving aside what I thought then were his ridiculous fantasies about the Inquisition. He'd still given me a lot to think about.
The situation here was undoubtedly far more complex than I'd been led to believe, and I needed to consider things carefully. So we took our leave of our kindly hosts, the waitress in particular looking sorry to see me go, and staggered up the stairway and into the street. The cold night air hit me like a refreshing shower, snapping me back to alertness, and I glanced around while Divas communed loudly with the Emperor in a convenient gutter. Fortunately, the bar he'd steered us to was down a quiet side alley, so no one saw the dignity of the Imperial uniform being sullied. Once I was sure there were no more eruptions to come, I helped him to his feet.
"You used to be able to hold it better than that," I chided, and he shook his head mournfully.
"Local rotgut, not like the stuff we used to drink. And I should have eaten something."
"It would have just been a wasted effort," I consoled him, and glanced around, trying to get our bearings. "Where the frack are we, anyway?"
"Dock zone," he said confidently, hardly swaying on his feet at all now.
"This way."
He strode off towards the nearest illuminated thoroughfare. I shrugged and followed him. After all, he'd had 3 weeks to get his bearings. As we made our way through the well-lit street, however, I began to feel a little apprehensive. True, we'd been deep in conversation on our way to the bar, but none of the landmarks looked familiar to me, and I began to wonder if his confidence had been